journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass dissent.
These are weapons of mass dissent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Tuesday, July 21st, 2009, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Students and teachers fight cuts to California universities. The real legacy of the Apollo space program on the 40th anniversary of the moon landing, and Salvadorians fight polluting corporations, plus this week's Empire Notes on Afghanistan.
But I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space, and none will be so difficult or expensive to accomplish.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Yesterday marked the 40th anniversary of when astronauts Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin took the first human steps and planted an American flag on the surface of the moon. The event was the culmination of nearly a decade-long effort through the Apollo space program, which cost $25 billion in 1969. Those moments we just heard were watched or listened to by 500 million people across the globe. But the moon landing was not just an event designed to inspire awe all over the world. It took place in the context of the Cold War and was also used as a way to demonstrate American supremacy over the Soviet Union. The event was also used to justify decades of funding for space weapons research, into which billions of dollars have been dedicated. The Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank, published an op-ed on the occasion of the 40th anniversary, clearly stating that, quote, "space remains a critical enabler of America's military power." In 2003, 70% of the weapons used by the Pentagon in its invasion of Iraq were a result of space technology. Today, despite the financial recession, President Obama has boosted funding for NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, in the 2010 federal budget to the tune of $18.7 billion. Still, the majority of Americans support the space program and agree that the benefits have outweighed the costs, this according to a new Gallup poll. Joining me on the phone now is Bruce Gagnon. He is the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. Welcome to Uprising, Bruce.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning, and thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be with you again.
So first, let's talk about the way in which this moon landing on its 40th anniversary is being discussed in the media. A lot of newspapers are sort of reliving those moments. There's a lot of awe. People feel very proud. How do you assess the media coverage of this 40th anniversary?
Well, basically boosterism, public relations, in order to continue to inspire the American people to hand over huge amounts of money for the control of space. We have to recognize that today the Space Command, the Pentagon Command that was created in order to give the United States control and domination of space, they want to build essentially a parallel military highway between the Earth and the planetary bodies, so that the United States will control the pathway on and off the planet Earth in the coming years. The aerospace industry has long bragged that this will be the largest industrial project in the history of the planet Earth, necessitating a massive expenditure of funds. So you have to keep the American people on board and thinking that it's about going out and looking for the origins of life and exploring the heavens for the benefit of all humankind. But it's not really about that at all. Interestingly, in 1959, the United States Army created a secret project called Project Horizon, a U.S. Army study for the establishment of a lunar outpost. And let me just read one or two sentences from that to give you an idea of the vision that has long been there. This is from the Army, at that time declared secret report, has been since released, of course, to the public. They say, quote, the lunar outpost is required to develop and protect potential United States interests on the moon and for military operations on the moon if required. Any military operations on the moon will be difficult to counter by the enemy because of the difficulty of his reaching the moon if our forces are already present and have means of countering a landing or of neutralizing any hostile forces that have landed. So the Pentagon has long recognized that there's such a thing as the Earth-Moon gravity well, and whoever controls the moon will control basically who can get on and off the planet Earth. And thus, you will control the extraction of resources in the coming years. The United Nations, fearing instability and tensions, created the Moon Treaty in 1979 that said no one country, no corporation, no individual can claim ownership of the moon. And the United States, to this day, has never signed the Moon Treaty.
Well, I suppose the simple act of planting an American flag on the moon as one of the first actions is pretty clear. Let's look at a little bit of the political history as well, Bruce. As I mentioned, the race to put a man on the moon was very much part of the Cold War at the time. But how much of it was about actually putting a man on the moon, and how much of it was a space arms race?
Well, I think it was definitely about justifying the space arms race, creating a line item, if you will, in the federal budget to massively build the technology base to control space and thus to control the Earth as well. And so, again, it was sold in a public relations format. It was sold to the American people as this noble effort to go out and explore space and to go and look at the moon and everything else. It was dressed up, in other words, but it was clearly about developing these space military technologies.
President Obama yesterday spoke with the Apollo 11 astronauts in a very public press conference and talked about excellence in exploration and discovery. A lot of the public relations part of this is focused on space exploration, and certainly there has been a lot of funding through NASA to the fields of astronomy. But how much, you know, do you know the numbers in terms of percentage-wise, how much of it is going into weapons technology, that is destructive technology, versus constructive science and the potential for real technology that can actually help humanity?
I don't think anyone can really come up with those numbers, because the distinction between the two, the line between so-called civilian and military space, has been rubbed out. When a guy named Sean O'Keefe, the former Secretary of the Nuclear Navy, was appointed by George W. Bush early in his first administration as the new director of NASA, in his first press conference, Sean O'Keefe said, everything we do at NASA from now on will be dual use. Every mission we fly, every technology we create will be dual use. It will be both military and civilian at the same time. So they really concretized it at that time. But even prior to then, it's always been the NASA was a stalking horse, if you will, for the Pentagon. Just one illustration. In 1996, the Pentagon announced that the data that they acquired from the Clementine spacecraft indicates that there was ice on the moon and everything else, and everyone was all excited about that mission that went and, it was a sort of a flyby, an orbital reconnaissance mission of the moon. And it was all supposed to be a civilian NASA mission. Well, come to find out, the Pentagon paid for the development of that mission, and they were testing Star Wars sensors and other component technologies for the Department of Defense spacecraft on that particular mission. So it was just one example of how they used a so-called civilian space exploration mission to test Star Wars technology. So it's been that way for a very long time. And I think it's virtually impossible to break out those numbers.
I'm speaking with Bruce Gagnon, the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. We are discussing the 40th anniversary of the Apollo moon landing, which was just yesterday, and what its real legacy is. Now, a lot of the, again, public relations aspect of this, because, you know, I want to keep going back to what is presented versus what's really happening, is focusing on the technological benefits that we have gained. I mentioned the Gallup poll earlier where most Americans, a majority of Americans, about 58%, feel that the costs of this program over the decades has outweighed the benefits. And one article in the Examiner talks about the top five green tech spin-offs of the Apollo mission, and they cite environmental and resource management, consumer water purification systems, pool purification systems, home smoke detectors, and all sorts of interesting sort of technological spin-offs, air quality monitors, computer technology, industrial regulation. How do you respond to this? I mean, is it not true that some of this technology, which is very useful in our day-to-day lives today, is a direct result of this program?
Oh, yeah, of course it is. But the way I look at it is if you invest hundreds of billions of dollars over this period of years, essentially since World War II, you're bound to get something out of it. You're bound, yes, to get aluminum foil and tang and a few other things as well. There's no doubt about that. But you have to ask the question, what if you had taken that same sum of money and put it into developing rail technologies, connecting every corner of this country, developing solar and wind technologies, developing technologies on this earth that would have helped us get away from our oil addiction, would be helping us be solving for the coming realities of climate change that are going to be very harsh and just in the next few years. So, you know, I think it's all a matter of priorities, and I think we've made the wrong priorities.
What about what's happening today? How much of the expenditure on this space program is, you know, being diverted to weapons technology versus, say, green technology? Is it still this prevalence of dual use? And how does NASA and the other space programs, how do they justify these continuing costs to the tune of billions of dollars at a time when we're in a financial recession?
Well, they justify it by, again, the huge, enormous public relations campaign that they're able to put forward. The aerospace industry is making massive profits off the space program. Let me just give one illustration. Just a week ago, it was announced that the International Space Station will be deorbited in 2016. And that means they're going to bring it back to Earth, drop it down, and as it reenters Earth orbit, it will burn up on reentry and fall apart in little pieces into the Pacific Ocean. Originally, the cost of the International Space Station to taxpayers was going to be $10 billion. Today, the cost is now at $100 billion, and it's not quite finished, but by the time they finish it, they will then deorbit it. And the reason why they're going to deorbit it, they say, is because when they end the shuttle program, next year, the space shuttle program, they're not going to have a way to get astronauts to the space station unless they fly on Russian rockets. So this, I think, illustrates what a massive, massive expenditure this program is. And this is not a rare example. Every single NASA and U.S. military space program is 100, 200, 300, 400% over budget. And so these corporations have massive resources, taxpayer resources, at their disposal to then go out and create a public relations campaign like we've never seen before in history. They have a process all over America to step inside of virtually every science classroom at every elementary school and high school in this nation, where they're indoctrinating young people about the value of space, because they recognize that, number one, whoever controls space militarily will control the Earth, and number two, the enormous profits to be made are just beyond anything in the history of humankind. So they have incredible resources to carry out that program.
Bruce, would you be for the complete then, or for a severe delinking of weapons technology through the space program and exploration science, understanding what lies beyond the Earth and even the solar system? Would you be in favor of that? Exploration by itself, of course, does cost money, but I'm guessing much less money if the weapons part of it were to be laid to rest.
Oh, absolutely. I think there are some values. I don't want to be completely negative about space technology. I mean, we use space technology to communicate through the computer and through our cell phones and cable television and weather observation. There are some values of space technology today, but I think you're exactly right. The delinking of the military and the civilian, number one, is very important. And it would allow, I think, a global response to space. We need to end this kind of nationalistic competition for control of space, which is doing nothing but creating a new arms race, creating more space debris, more space junk orbiting the Earth that they're now worried about is going to become such a problem that we won't even at some point be able to get rockets off the planet Earth because of the growing amounts of space debris. So there are all kinds of reasons to take the military out of the space program. But right now, the military is what runs the space program, and I would submit that the military-industrial complex runs our government. So it's a big challenge, and I'm not sure the American people even have half the story about what's going on. So it's difficult for them to really respond.
Well, it's incredible. I mean, just trying to sift through the vast amount of media coverage on the 40th anniversary of the moon landing, I didn't find a single news article that actually emphasized how much of the space program is devoted to the military and to military uses and to weapons technology. So it's definitely a pretty big curtain being drawn over people's eyes. Finally, Bruce, what should we be looking out for today in terms of new programs in the works, new and dangerous programs in the works that we should be keeping our eyes open for in terms of taxpayers' money also being spent as well as enabling continued wars?
I think the revolution in miniaturization of technology, the robotics that is now driving space technology. We're now seeing these unmanned aerial vehicles, or drones as we call them.
Are those a direct result of space technology?
Oh, yeah.
The ones being used in Pakistan and the Northwest Frontier Province?
Exactly. They're flown by satellites. They're flown by pilots sitting at Creech Air Force Base outside of Las Vegas, Nevada, staring at a computer screen with a joystick directly linked to the UAV flying over Afghanistan and Pakistan by military satellites. So space technology is creating a revolution in robotic and warfighting. This will become even more dangerous because it will allow the Pentagon to feel that they're not putting the lives of American troops in danger as they go, and as we're finding today in Afghanistan and Pakistan, kill legions of civilians with these drones. So I think this the robotic explosion is going to be very dangerous, and it's all going to be directed by space technology.
Well, Bruce Gagnon, is there a website you can recommend?
Yes, go to our website at spaceforpeace.org, spaceforpeace.org, and we have much of the things that we were just talking about right on there.
That's space4peace.org. Bruce, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you.
Bruce Gagnon is coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. We've been discussing the untold legacy of the Apollo moon landing 40 years after it first happened. This is Uprising, and later in the hour, we'll go live to a rally where Cal State students are currently gathering outside of the Chancellor's office at Cal State Long Beach for a day-long protest against tuition hikes. We'll also hear today's subversive historian right after we go to El Salvador to take a look at how corporations are fighting for the right to pollute. But first, this week's Empire Notes. Empire Notes are weekly commentaries filed by Rahul Mahajan, author of Full Spectrum Dominance and The New Crusade. Today's commentary is on the so-called Good War.
Escalation in Afghanistan and Pakistan is a central component of Barack Obama's new approved war on terror. Current plans are to ramp up to a presence of 70,000 American troops in Afghanistan, and diplomatic efforts to increase the size of the NATO contingent are constantly underway. This new offensive comes at a time when the American public is sick of faraway countries, the spending of imaginary funds on helping poor benighted Muslims, and even of the continued absence of American troops. Somehow many have convinced themselves that they care about this, even when they have no friends or family in the armed forces. As a result, even this goodest of all good wars has minimal support. Indeed, a USA Today poll earlier this year found 42% of Americans saying the Afghanistan war was a mistake. Although elite opinion is much more unified in support of Obama's escalation, there are cracks in this facade as well. If nothing else, Stanley McChrystal's repeated emphasis on the fact that a solution in Afghanistan will have to be political more than military is an indirect reflection of these cracks. By the time this had become the dominant theme in public remarks about Vietnam, everyone knew the United States was losing. Thus the need for a new propaganda offensive. Peter Bergen's widely discussed essay, Winning the Good War, in the latest issue of the liberal Washington Monthly, is a case in point. It's structured as a refutation of the argument that Afghanistan will be Obama's Vietnam. First, he says, this is not a replay of the Soviets in Afghanistan. They were brutal and ham-handed, resistance was much more widespread, and there was a fairly important outside power aiding that resistance. Second, he says, Afghanistan is actually far more governable than Iraq, and violence even now is lower. Also, Afghans support the presence of international forces, while Iraqis opposed it. Third, Afghanistan has been a unified nation for longer than the United States, and Afghans have a strong sense of nationalism. For some reason, this augurs well for the occupation. Fourth, it's not like Vietnam because the NLF was much larger and better armed than the neo-Taliban. See argument above. Fifth, withdrawal can't be the answer because we tried it before and the result was disaster. And finally, more troops will decrease civilian casualties, not increase them, because it will enable us to cut down on bombing raids. Most of his facts are accurate, and some of the arguments he tries to refute are really silly. If only I had a dime for every idiot column claiming that Afghanistan has been the graveyard of empires for 2,500 years and that it will wreck the United States, too. It's also true that polls show a significant majority of Afghans in support of the presence of U.S. and NATO forces, and that Afghanistan is nothing like Vietnam. Nevertheless, it's not difficult to see that Bergen is caught up in the same blindness as, say, Thomas Friedman in 2005 regarding Iraq, and of untold liberal intellectuals in every counterinsurgency since the beginning of recorded history. Here's a different reading of some of the same facts. The fact that in a recent ABC poll, 63% of Afghan respondents supported the presence of U.S. troops in Afghanistan, while only 8% supported that of the neo-Taliban, is a welcome indication that the 8-year occupation has not yet done irreparable damage, and indicates an opportunity to move the policy in a very different direction than that of counterinsurgency. That lack of irreparable damage does not mean the U.S. has done much good. Indeed, 63% thought the U.S. had done a fair or poor job, and a slight majority has an unfavorable opinion of the U.S. Furthermore, 18% favored escalation, with 44% opposing, and an overwhelming 77% said the use of airstrikes was unacceptable. Hamid Karzai has also repeatedly gone on record opposing U.S. escalation and favoring attempts at a negotiated settlement. Although there's been a flurry of stories about a new, kinder, gentler approach in Afghanistan, the truth is that airstrikes will remain a major component of the counterinsurgency, and that whenever the Taliban is able to inflict significant casualties on American troops, force protection will trump other considerations. The likelihood of doing further damage is great. The chance that some good will be done seems minuscule. I see in Washington neither the ability nor the political will to come up with and implement a strategy for a political solution. For Empire Notes, this is Rahul Mahajan.
Visit www.empirenotes.org for more information. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. President Mauricio Funes of El Salvador has refused to issue a permit to a Canadian company seeking to mine gold on the grounds of environmental pollution. In response, the Pacific Rim Mining Corporation is suing the Central American nation for $100 million, claiming that it is in violation of CAFTA's non-discrimination provision. The Central America Free Trade Agreement, which binds countries like El Salvador to the U.S.'s rules of free trade, is being invoked on the grounds that allowing domestic companies the privilege to pollute El Salvador puts international companies like Pacific Rim at a market disadvantage. Because of the use of cyanide-laced water to extract the precious metal from subterranean rock, gold mining results in soil and ground contamination, which, experts contend, eventually finds its way down into the drinking water of El Salvador. The National Working Group Against Mining in El Salvador, or MESA, has led the fight against banning metal mining. This popular organization has brought the issue into the consciousness of ordinary Salvadorians and has found an ally in the Catholic Church. The church recently released a statement against mining, saying that no material advantage can be compared with the value of human life. Joining me now is Claudia Rodriguez. She is the advocacy director of the Share Foundation. Welcome to Uprising, Claudia.
Okay. Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much for joining us. First, let's talk about gold mining in El Salvador itself and metal mining. What do you make of Pacific Rim's argument that they're being discriminated against because domestic companies are already doing this in El Salvador and are able to pollute freely and make money?
Oh, well, that's a flawed argument because, Pacific Rim hasn't been mining gold already, but they have already causing a lot of environmental damage. Right now...
How do they cause environmental damage without actually mining? What are they doing currently in El Salvador?
Oh, they are doing exploration. Basically, they drill to the rock, and what has been happening is that they are actually drying out wells that belong to communities, leaving like dozens of communities without drinking water. And these are communities that don't have access to pipe water. So, they rely on wells. And if, Pacific Rim has been doing these activities and drying out those wells, that's a huge issue for the communities.
So, under CAFTA, is this the first time in El Salvador that a corporation is basically invoking CAFTA to insert its right to do business there?
Yeah, it's the first. The first arbitration under CAFTA.
Given that El Salvador's recent sort of political dynamic change is towards the left, how has the new government under Mauricio Funes with the FMLN in power, how has it responded to this?
About a month ago, the FMLN actually introduced a bill kind of rescuing the bill that was introduced 2 years ago by the National Working Group Against Mining, which we call La Mesa for short. La Mesa introduced this bill 2 years ago, hoping that the legislature was going to approve it and then coal mining could be banned in the country. That bill was never discussed, so the FMLN, after the elections, introduced this other piece of legislature, basically stating the same thing, prohibiting mining in the country and giving the mining companies already operating in the country 6 months to, close down operations. This bill hasn't been discussed yet, but, was recently introduced, so we are waiting to see what happened. And there was this news in one of the conservative newspapers saying that Mauricio Funes, main advisor, has said that Mauricio's administration was willing to negotiate with the Canadian company and maybe to get to an agreement since the country couldn't afford to pay that much money. Almost $100 million that they could use for social programs. That's what the news said, but then after interviews with different people from the government, we understand that those statements were placed out of context by the newspaper, that actually what he was referring to was another conflict regarding another environmental issue with a European Union firm, and the European firm was able to negotiate with the government, and they were not going to sue. So that was what he was referring to when he gave those statements, not to Pacific Rim. So we are hoping, the social movement is hoping, that the administration of Funes is going to be strong enough and it's not going to, you know, negotiate with Pacific Rim at this point.
Now, Pacific Rim is a Canadian company, but CAFTA is an agreement between the United States and Central American countries. How is it that Pacific Rim can use CAFTA to assert its apparent right to mine in El Salvador?
Pacific Rim went through the back doors, how we call it. He's using a subsidiary they have in Nevada.
So it's an American subsidiary?
Yeah, an American subsidiary is Pacific Rim Cayman, and it's based in Nevada. So that's how they are doing it.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Claudia Rodriguez. She is the advocacy director of the SHARE Foundation, which is based in Washington, D.C. We're talking about the CAFTA, the Central America Free Trade Agreement. Listeners may recall we had done a lot of coverage on CAFTA when it was being negotiated, when there was a lot of effort to prevent Congress here from passing it, as well as in countries like El Salvador. It did pass, and now a company through an American subsidiary is trying to use CAFTA for the first time in El Salvador to assert its right to mine gold, a very polluting process. Let's talk about what the pollution does do. You mentioned that Pacific Rim is already exploring and causing a lot of pollution, but if it were to actually mine gold, would it contaminate pretty seriously the groundwater systems in the country?
Oh, yes, because of Salvadoran geology. You know, all the mining districts are along the basin of the main river. It's called the Rio Lempa. It's basically the river runs almost through half of the country. And what is happening is that even though Pacific Rim has claimed that they are going to conduct green mining, they are going to use cyanide.
Green mining.
Yeah, green mining.
It seems as though any time you attach the word green to any sort of technological effort, people are expected to assume that it's good for the earth.
Yeah, but it's not, definitely. And
so they're still going to use water laced with cyanide in its exploration.
Uh-huh. And even though they are saying they are going to isolate the, you know, they have like, I don't know, like the mining terms, but it's like a, they isolate the water with cyanide so it doesn't run into the main water sources. But because there are two issues here. First, the country is geologically unstable. So, it's, you know, it shakes every day, basically. Even you cannot perceive it, but it's moving every day. So you have continuous cracking of the soil. That will mean that the water, the contaminated water can filter down to sources of drinking water that the community is already using. That's one. And then you always have spillovers. And if you have the main river that provides most of the drinking water for the country, we are talking about a huge issue, you know, that is going to affect thousands of thousands of people.
Let's talk about the social movements that are involved in fighting this. Group called MESA, the National Working Group Against Mining in El Salvador, what efforts has it undertaken to fight against what Pacific Rim is doing?
Well, this is a truly amazing group because it's an umbrella organization conformed by small grassroots organizations. So we're talking about people from the communities being affected, organizing themselves to face the threat of mining. So they started organizing in the north of the country where the mining districts are. And, you know, step by step they started organizing and then having, like, building relations across the country with bigger organizations and also with international organizations from Guatemala and Honduras who already have a big issue because they, you know, they have the industry already operating in those countries. So basically people travel to see the experience by the communities in Honduras in Guatemala and learned about that and came back to the country and shared these concerns to the rest of Salvadorans. And also they have gotten support from other development organizations, such as the Share Foundation, the organization I work for, and Oxfam and Catholic Relief Services.
Claudia, tell us about Marcelo Rivera, an anti-mining activist who just recently, I understand, was murdered. What can you tell us about who he was and the circumstances surrounding his murder?
That's a very unfortunate case. Marcelo Rivera was a natural leader from the community of San Isidro. San Isidro is a town where Pacific Rim main program in Latin America is located, the Dorado Mine. The Dorado Mine is located in San Isidro. And Marcelo was the director of this hometown association called Friends of San Isidro Cabañas, and he was also the director of Casa de la Cultura. It's like a, you know, like an educational place, community center. So he led the grassroots organizing in the community. And we understand that the mayor of San Isidro was very interested in getting the industry for his municipality. So he was making friends with the company. So basically this movement, including Marcelo, was very unpopular to the local authorities because, you know, they were opposing to those projects, and not only mining, but, for example, the mayor wanted to start, like, a garbage dump in the municipality. And also Marcelo led the opposition to that.
So he was disappeared on June 18th of this year, and I understand his body was found in early July, showing signs of brutal torture, and some are saying that he was basically killed by a death squad. So we're talking really high-stakes life-and-death situation here.
Yeah, he was brutally tortured, even though the authorities have basically ignored the evidence from the forensic report. The authorities said, well, it's like a gang violence. You know, he was drinking with gang members, and then after a heated discussion, they kill him. But that's not what the evidence shows. The evidence shows that he was probably kept alive for several days while being tortured. And then he was, like, his body was thrown into this dry well.
A dry well. I'm speaking with Claudia Rodriguez. We've just been discussing Marcelo Rivera, an anti-mining activist in El Salvador who was recently disappeared and killed. This happening in the larger context of an international company, actually a Canadian company, through its U.S. subsidiary, fighting for the right to mine in El Salvador despite environmental pollution and using CAFTA to do it. Finally, Claudia, why should Americans here in this country care about what's happening in El Salvador in terms of CAFTA, you know, and also how do what sort of solidarity do you expect?
Basically, this brings us to the big picture about, you know, international free trade agreements. Right now, there is a discussion of the Trade Act. It's this initiative that was introduced by Representative Michu. He was one of the co-sponsors. What I ask from the American people is to follow up closely these developments in the U.S. Congress with these new bills that try to reform free trade agreements to limit, basically, one is to limit the corporation's power to sue developing countries, the governments from developing countries for compensation, cash compensation, when they feel like their interests have been violated. It's ironic that powerful corporations can do whatever they want, you know, with poor communities. And get a lot.
Well,
of
they have a right to their profits, I suppose. That's the that's the thinking here.
Yes.
And just in terms of the way in which free trade agreements are looked at, there was a lot of media coverage here in the United States, relatively speaking, on CAFTA when Congress was trying to pass it. Not as much happening right now as CAFTA is being exercised. Where can listeners find out credible information about this particular case in El Salvador? Do you have a website or anything you can recommend?
We have a lot of information about the mining issue and about, you know, free trade agreements. If you go to our website, it's share/elsalvador.org.
That's share, share-elsalvador.org. And also there's an article on fpif.org, that's Foreign Policy in Focus, by a writer named Michael Bush. And we will link to that article directly from our website later today at kpfk.org/uprising. Claudia Rodriguez, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Claudia Rodriguez is Advocacy Director with the SHARE Foundation. Again, share-elsalvador.org is the website. After today's Subversive Historian, we'll go live to a student rally protesting fee hikes at Cal State Long Beach. Stay tuned.
The Skirball Cultural Center presents the 13th season of its free sunset concert, celebrating musical traditions from around the globe Thursday nights this summer. This Thursday, July 23rd, the transatlantic spirit of folk comes to life as American Newgrass innovators Mike Marshall and Daryl Anger join forces with Swedish instrumental trio Vossen in the Ensemble's L.A. premiere. Together, the five virtuosos create a soundscape of rich global sounds, new acoustic music, and enduring melodies. Mike Marshall and Daryl Anger with Vossen in concert. Free at the Skirball, Thursday, July 23rd. Doors open at 7. For more information, call 310-440-4500 or visit kpfk.org. KPFK is a media sponsor for Sunset Concerts at the Skirball.
This is Gabriel San Roman, your subversive historian. Back in the day, on July 21st, 1972, comedian George Carlin was arrested during a performance in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, for allegedly violating obscenity laws. Launching into his notorious routine, Carlin uttered the seven words you can never say on television during the city's outdoor summer fest. Apparently, those seven words were also so heinous they couldn't be spoken on stage either. The routine was played as part of the subsequent trial and elicited laughter. Free on bail, Carlin finally beat the rap when the judge in the case called the words indecent but protected under free speech. The controversy over the routine quieted for just all of 1 year until it aired on Pacifica station WBAI in New York in 1973, causing the landmark lawsuit Pacifica versus the FCC. As a result, I can't tell you what the seven words are over the air. If I did, we would get fined. And if we got fined, we'd have to have another fun drive. And nobody wants that. For Uprising, this is your truth professor saying it's no mystery why they conceal our people's history.
You're listening to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. California lawmakers reached a deal to close the state's $26 billion budget gap just yesterday, agreeing on $15 billion in spending cuts. Of those cuts, $9 billion will be from education, $1.3 billion from state worker furloughs, and $1.2 billion from the prison system. The Democratic-controlled legislature is expected to vote on the budget this Thursday. Meanwhile, anticipating the severe cuts to education, University of California leaders voted last Thursday to enforce a furlough plan for 80% of its workers. With $813 million in cuts to account for, the Board of Regents overwhelmingly approved the plan by a margin of 20-1. If accepted by employee unions, the furlough slated to start on September 1st would mandate the taking of unpaid leave equal to a 4-10% reduction. Meanwhile, the Cal State University Board of Trustees is convening today in Long Beach to discuss and vote on plans for a possible 20% fee increase for students. The proposal by CSU Chancellor Charles Reed would follow a 10% tuition hike already approved in May and would raise the annual cost of education to over $4,000. In addition to possible fee increases, the CSU system announced earlier this month that applications for the spring 2009 semester are closed in an effort to reduce enrollment by 40,000 students over the next 2 years. Cal State has also sought approval of a furlough plan from its unionized employees. In response to all the measures that would raise fees, close classes, and lay off faculty members, students from all over the Cal State system's 23 campuses are at this very moment convening outside of the chancellor's office in Long Beach for a day-long protest. We now go live to that event with Vanessa Rojas. She's a student at Cal State Bakersfield. Welcome to Uprising, Vanessa.
Welcome. Thank you. Good morning.
We also, by the way, have Chris Newfield with us, a professor of English at UC Santa Barbara. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you. Thanks for covering this issue.
Vanessa, first let's talk to you about what's happening right now in front of Cal State Long Beach, the chancellor's office. How many students and others are there, and what exactly are your demands?
Currently, we have about 35 students out here, along with professors and faculty and staff. And our demand is that the 32% fee hike basically not be passed, that the Board of Trustees and the Chancellor really consider the impact that this would have on future generations as well as current students in the CSU system.
So you're saying 32% because there was a 10% hike already approved, and now they're going to try to approve a 20% hike, so about 30%.
Right, that's correct, because cumulative total would be 32%.
Mm-hmm. Chris Newfield, I mentioned the UC, similar situation at the UC system. Can you talk about the potential layoffs of professors and other teaching faculty and other administration, and how that would devastate the UC system, in your opinion?
Well, they haven't announced layoffs as a systematic policy. They instead have said that the furloughs will prevent most layoffs in the short term. They're really not talking about that or giving numbers. The furloughs, however, will take faculty and staff out of the classroom and off the job for anywhere from 11 to 21 days next year. And there are faculty and staff that are at this moment planning to organize those furloughs so that they're as visible as possible and so that the state of California, the public and its leaders, have a clearer sense than they may have right now about the devastating effects of these kinds of economies.
Vanessa, how serious would these tuition hikes be for students? I mean, if tuition were to be raised 30%, what would that mean for a student like yourself?
When calculated, a 32% fee hike would be $1,000 annually. And so students like myself who are already doing the best that they can, working and, you know, trying to stay into the system, it would potentially mean accumulating either more debt or having to prolong the graduation.
And also, Vanessa, why is it that there are only 35 students at the protest right now? I mean, I'm imagining more may come in as the day progresses, but are enough students in the Cal State system aware of what's happening?
Oh, absolutely. We have actually students coming down from different CSUs. For example, we have a caravan that's coming down from San Francisco. We're expecting to have about 300 students, professors, and staff here. So I know that this is just the beginning. It's very early in the morning, but we're expecting throughout the day for our numbers to increase drastically.
Professor Newfield, I mentioned the news of the budget deal reached yesterday with $9 billion in cuts to education. What do you make of this whole political discussion in Sacramento with the Democrats being in the majority? There were no new tax cuts passed. So basically, it means the Republicans won, and the majority of the budget deal was based on cuts to spending.
Right. Well, we have a minority rule situation in where one-third of the Republicans can dictate policy to the rest, and we've had that for quite some time. So there's a political reform that has to happen. I think the other thing that people need to realize, too, is that these cuts have been built into public policy. The fee hikes that Vanessa's talking about have been built into public policy for 5 years under this thing called the Compact for Higher Education. And with the sense of financial crisis, most people think that there's really not that much point in protesting because there isn't any money. It's not true. California is a wealthy state, its expenditures and its educational outcomes are now in the bottom 10 of the 50 states and approaching a 50th rapidly. So there's a sense of fatalism that I think has to be overcome, and what we're trying to do is instill a sense of the immediate effects of these kinds of cuts so that people will feel like they have no choice but to react and to fix things.
And, Chris,
last thing about this. For me, it's just completely irresponsible to have a 100% cut budget solution. It's utterly imbalanced. It violates even the traditions of previous Republican governors. And I'm actually surprised that people aren't more outraged by the way that this is going.
I want to pose a question both to Chris and to Vanessa. At a time when the economic recession is pretty severe, students, young people in California, I imagine, are hoping to rely on getting a decent education in order to be more trained for those few jobs that are left out there. Yet the CSU is deliberately aiming for a 40,000 student reduction over the next couple of years. I mean, they're effectively saying we are going to deliberately educate fewer students. Chris, what is that going to mean for the future of California?
Well, California started out as a plantation state where they educated a small elite and everybody else was essentially functional. And they started making better decisions after World War I and especially after World War II. In the last 30 years, they've increased poverty and inequality more or less systematically with cuts. Actually, the flattening of expenditures for most public services and the reduction of the public service that is really future-oriented, which is K through 12 in real terms, and especially higher education. I think that people don't understand the implications of this kind of a reversal. We built up all this principle after World War II. Tax cutters came in and were able to essentially act like spoiled children and just assume that all of that infrastructure and all of the investment was already there. The investment's over. The investment's been declining for 30 years, and we have no choice now but to build it back up. Mm-hmm. I just think it's short-sightedness right now and ignorance of the history.
Vanessa, your response on the fact that 40,000 students are going to be cut, and also I understand that just even things like transfers of students into the Cal State system from junior colleges have been stopped now for 2 years in a row. So students who started out at community colleges hoping to make it into a Cal State university are also being denied that.
I absolutely think that it's going to devastate the future because, as the professor was saying, this is a long-term impact and the implications of it are going to far extend. Education is an investment, and that's something that I think that we have to keep in mind because as you invest in education, you're also generating revenue and jobs. I mean, the students coming from the CSU are teachers, lawyers, you know, they're the future professors, and so when you cut back on them, you're cutting back on the future of California.
But also in terms of, where these students are now going to go, Vanessa, you know, what's going to happen to young people who either can't afford, not that it was ever seriously affordable, but even for those who could afford earlier but can't now, what's going to happen to them? Where are they going to go?
It's basically a closed-door situation, or they're going to have to change their career plans or find another manner to attain education because students, you know, who are trying to transfer in and unfortunately are now faced with the situation don't have a choice. So basically what we're saying is that this is closing the doors on them.
Vanessa, you mentioned earlier that the students at Cal State universities are quite aware of these fee hikes that are going to affect them. But do you think Californians at large understand what's happening?
I would hope so. I think that this is such a large-scale issue that I think that it's one that needs to be, prioritize, and I think that we need to get informed and become activists and really just take these issues and educate others about them.
You came a pretty long way from Bakersfield to Long Beach. What's at stake for you personally?
Personally, I would say that my dreams. I'm going to be an English teacher, so for me, education is my pathway to get there. And I'm also taking into consideration the fact that my little brother and sister are dreaming about going to college one day. So for me, this is a not only a personal dream, but it's also a family dream that I'm fighting for and that I'm standing up for.
Vanessa Rojas is a student at Cal State Bakersfield. She's speaking to us via cell phone live from Long Beach in front of the chancellor's office, where students are going to be gathering all day today from all the way through 4 p.m. protesting where the chancellor's the Board of Trustees, rather, is meeting to vote on an additional 20% fee hike, raising the total fee hike to Cal State students to 32%. It's happening at 401 Golden Shore in Long Beach all day today through 4 p.m. Finally, Chris Newfield, you mentioned the attitude of sort of defeatism, but what can the Board of Trustees at Cal State Universities and UC Systems do when it's being handed down from the state? Aren't they in a difficult position at this time as well?
They are, but they haven't put out the crucial message to the legislature and to the public, which is that you can't have a great public university system, all three sectors that we've talked about, without having huge public financing.
The so you're saying that they've just sort of rolled over and accepted it?
Yeah. Their model is we can use private money to substitute for public. It's not true. It's just arithmetically false. But that message hasn't sunk in. It's more efficient, and it's more just as well to fund public higher education with public funds.
And so,
and that's the message that they have not yet transmitted. They haven't really started to fight that particular battle.
Is it possible that this crisis is being used as a way to further privatize the university system?
Yeah, I don't think most people want that in the broad sense, but it's absolutely what's going to happen. There'll be gated communities of excellence, law schools and business schools and medical schools, and the general campuses that train undergraduates will become increasingly poor and increasingly unable to deliver the high quality to the large numbers that was the original vision of the master plan. Mm-hmm. But we could also appeal to the self-interest of Californians just economically. They are Herbert Hooverizing the California economy, even as we speak. Arnold Schwarzenegger is acting like the reincarnation of that terrible president, and he's taking money away from people, out of people's pockets, out of employees' pockets, and he's throwing students onto the street at a moment when there are no jobs for them.
Well, Chris Newfield, I want to wish you the best of luck, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Chris Newfield is a professor of English at UC Santa Barbara. We've been discussing with him, as well as a student at Cal State Bakersfield, the current crisis facing both the UC and CSU systems. For Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day, Aristotle once said, "All who have meditated on the art of governing mankind have been convinced that the fate of empires depends on the education of youth." That's Aristotle, and that's Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day. You've been listening to Uprising. To get a CD of today's program, contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or online at pacificaradioarchives.org. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Steve Gill and Stephanie De Leon are our interns. Melissa Figueroa is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of this show after 10 a.m. on our website, kpfk.org/uprising. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. See you tomorrow at 8.